Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Todd McGowan from the University of Vermont.
Todd. Welcome. Are you in Vermont as we speak?
I am in Vermont right now, yes.
A lovely state, and a state where the last time I was there were no billboards allowed on the roads. Is
That
that
is still true.
today's?
I think it's the only state in the union that does not allow billboards, which is great for the aesthetic, but it's not so great when you're running out of gas on the highway. And you're like, I really wish we had a billboard to tell me where there's an open gas station.
That's funny. That's funny. Yeah, point taken. So, Prof, I wanted to begin our conversation, other than the one about no billboards in Vermont. Maybe that was pre-Bernie too, I guess, right? He would just have
Yeah,
been
oh yeah,
mayor
yeah,
of
for sure,
Burlington
for
or
sure.
something. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was mayor of Burlington, but
Yeah.
that predates him for sure.
Yeah. Don't mess with Vermont. So I wonder if we could begin by my asking you my stereotypical question at this point, which is to invite you to share with us what are the things that are currently preoccupying, dynamizing, interesting, retarding you?
Okay, good. Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think I'm preoccupied. I think all those are usually one to me, all those things. The things that retard me are also the things that dynamize me. I would say that it's the current political situation and the rise of these right-wing populist regimes seemingly everywhere in the world, and the way that capitalism seems in a kind of a death spiral, and the result is not going to be a egalitarian emancipation from it, but a kind of, I was thinking of that French group, socialism or barbarism, and I feel like we're headed toward barbarism. So that really is, and I worry about, I have twin sons who are 20, and that preoccupies me for them. And for myself, yeah, I mean, that maybe I'll still be around for the worst, but I don't know. So that, yeah, that does preoccupy me quite a bit.
Can I ask you about the twin sons and what
Sure.
they
Yeah.
do? I mean, are they carrying the socialist banner somewhere?
I think so. One, they're both. One is a pre-med Englishman. They both go to the University of Vermont because it's free, and so we didn't give them any choice. Much to their chagrin, we didn't give them any college choice. And one is an English pre-med major, and the other is a film major who wants to be a screenwriter. So they're both kind of. And they're both politically, they're not, neither have had the reverse revolution of the one I had. So I went to the university as a deep, deep Reagan conservative, and then I turned into a communist, so much to my parents' chagrin. They haven't had the reverse. So yeah, so I think they're still in the political fold. So that's, which is nice. Because,
I have to ask you what happened to a young Tom,
well, yeah.
oh,
That's a
please,
good,
because
yeah, it's a good
this could
question.
be the
So,
clue to our salvation.
I don't know about
The
that,
elixir may
but
reside in your personal biography.
that's very sweet of you, but I don't know about that. So I read, I think I was maybe open to it anyway, because I was very taken by existentialist philosophy as a kid. And so I think that, you know, if you're reading Jean-Paul Sartre in high school, you're probably on the verge of a political conversion anyway. And I mean, how many Reagan supporters have read Being a Nothing? That's probably very, the number is probably very limited. Maybe there was one. Yeah, that's probably it. Although read Being a Nothing at that time, I think that's a loose use of the term read, but I'll tell you what, the encounter was with two books. So first was with Marxist Communist Manifesto. And then I read, this is a fascinating, no one would ever think this book, but I read this book by this sociologist named Peter Berger called Invitation to Sociology. And it just kind of, and
Yeah.
just that idea that, oh, wait, there's other viewpoints on the world, that was a shattering thing to me. And I, and then, and the, I had a very, the professor was a, was very, I was very, I had a lot of transference with him. And so I think that, and he was a pretty radical leftist, although not in a way that, and he was also, what was good was I played American football in college, and he was an athlete too. So I think that made it more likely that he was going to have that effect on me.
And you've got a Bengals t-shirt on, so
I do have a Bengals t-shirt. Yeah, I'm
you've
from
never given
Ohio,
up,
so
right?
yeah, I have not given it up. No. Still
So,
sports junkie.
Prof, you've mentioned transference with
Can
reference.
you call me Todd? Because Prof just it just I have no investment in that symbolic title.
Sure.
Sorry, you can call me
No,
whatever you
not at
want. I
all.
won't. I won't.
Not at all. It's fine. So, you've mentioned transference with reference to one of your teachers. And prior to that, you also talked about capitalism's death spiral. Psychoanalysis and death have an interesting relationship, and at least one of your books, I've only got some of them, but at least one of your books is an application of psychoanalytic thinking to capitalism, let's say.
Yeah.
Where's the death drive in all of this, or is that the wrong formulation?
No, it's not the wrong formulation at all. I'm very invested in the idea of death drive. That book, actually, it's called Capitalism and Desire. It was originally about how capitalism like derails, tries to divert, like I don't know, it takes away, it doesn't allow us to see the role that death drive plays in our existence, right? But a friend of mine, Mari Rudy, convinced me that, yeah, you're kind of t it's too it's a little t the book would have a wider appeal if I just talked about desire and didn't get so caught up in this psychoanalytic jargon. And I think that she was probably right about that, but part of me laments, actually, I the one my sort of lifelong dream project is, and I've written maybe half of it, is a book on death drive. And I think that, but I do think that's right, that I think that capitalism, clearly death drive is operative in capitalism, but I think it also tries to like hold out this promise of we can escape our death drive and get into some kind of unalienated future, right? So this promise of this hope for the future, I think, and a future of happiness, or some escape from this drive that keeps undermining, in which we undermine ourselves. And I think that and even the way that people that you know the main ideologists of capitalism talk, like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, like they don't believe, they think we act out of our self-interest. And I think one of the great ideas of psychoanalysis is no one's ever acted out of their self-interest, because they're constantly undermining it all the time, unconsciously, right? And so I think that idea can't jibe with the way capital sees itself, right? And the way capital propagates itself.
And I guess one point about Freud here that you touch on in the book, as I recall, is that at one level he says this is not sociology, it's not world history, it's not anthropology, it's clinical. But then he writes Civilization and Its Discontents, and he's clearly trying to understand the First World War, amongst
Yeah.
other things, right?
Yeah.
So there is this macro level that he can't get away from, it seems, even though it's all meant to be an empirical science that is observational and clinical. Is that fair to say? Is that roughly the kind of dilemma
I
that
think it's a great point by
comes
you,
with?
actually. I think it's a great point that he, and I think you're capturing it so well, because it's almost against himself that he gets pushed in this direction of philosophical or sociological, political exploration, right? Like he's like, no, I'm just focused on this scientific thing about the empirical. I'm creating an empirical science, but then, what's he doing in Totem and Tabu then initially, and then what's he doing in Future of an Illusion, and what's he doing especially in the book you mentioned, with the great book of 1930? Maybe I think it's the book I teach the most often. Maybe it's the greatest book, Civilization is Discontents, right? And it's like it's just pure speculation, right? It's pure speculation about the nature of society, the nature of the antagonism between the individual and the social structure. And it's so great. And I think he can't help himself, right? He feels compelled to bring the insights of psychoanalysis into the social realm. He can't not do it, which I really appreciate.
At the same time, in that book, that very important book, you wrote about capitalism and desire, you are not 100% invested, it seems to me, in the relationship that is sort of, capitalism to be understood through some blend of psychoanalysis and Marxism. You have your doubts about how these things can intersect.
Yeah, well, I especially my doubts about how they've historically intersected, right? Like I think most so-called psychoanalytic Marxisms or Marxist psychoanalytic analyses have not, I think they've not been great. So that's part of what I'm pushing off against there. But I don't, yeah, can they, I think there is a, but I do, I love your shirt, by the way. You have a shirt of Marx. So yeah. Which says class dismissed underneath Marx's head. So I really love that. There's some great jokes about Marx and class at the university, which maybe we should get into later. But I think that there is a disjunction between psychoanalysis and Marxism, precisely on this what Freud was talking about. Like, I don't know how well psychoanalysis can. I think. How well how, is it great for being mobilized for class struggle? I'm not sure. And then on the other hand, how well can you integrate ideas like death drive or unconscious into a Marxist analysis? And especially that thing that we were just talking about the antagonism between the individual and the social order. I don't, I, how can that be integrated into Marxism really well? So I do, yeah, you're right that I am kind of attentive to that disjunction between those two ways of thinking. And I don't know, I've tried to, I have another book coming out later called Pure X this year called Pure Excess. And I'm trying to push that a little. It's sort of a sequel to Capitalism and Desire, but trying to push that a little bit further and see if I can. But I do think that that's I don't think that book that I wrote adequately thinks through that bringing together, but I don't think anyone has done it. But maybe it's not possible to have happen, right?
Can I ask you then about the application of psychoanalysis to, shall we call them imaginative texts, which has been going on for a long time with reference to literature, and obviously Freud did that himself, Lacan did that himself, and that you've been one of the people to specialize in, especially apply, particularly applying this to film.
Yeah.
Is there something particular to film that makes psychoanalysis an appropriate, if not the best, means of understanding how stories unfold and the pro what the processes are of stitching spectators into narrative?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think, I don't know if you find this to be true, but I have that when I read a psychoanalytic account of literature, I think like, oh, that's pretty good and I'm invested in it fine. But it doesn't seem as like on its home turf as much as a psychoanalytic account of film. And I wonder if it's because two things. Psychoanalysis and film were invented in exactly the same year. 1895, which I think is not just coincidental. And the fact that Freud, that the great text, the originary text is Interpretation of Dreams. And I think a film is basically a public version of a dream. And so I really feel like that there's something about the interpretation of a film that follows the line of psychoanalytic interpretation for those reasons that it's a way that unlike other art forms, although Freud himself was not a fan of the cinema, which is an interesting thing. And I wonder if he didn't think that it's almost competition for psychoanalysis, because I feel like when I've been thinking about cinema and relative to psychoanalysis, I often find that different psychoanalytic ideas are pushed in a different direction or even further by cinema than they are theoretically. So it's not just like, oh, I'm applying the framework, but instead it's, oh, I have to rethink what I'm applying or what I'm how I'm thinking about.
One of the interesting things, I guess, is that many of the people who came to be founders of film art, not just in the avant-garde, but in fact in conventional narrative cinema, were early advocates of Freudianism. There was desire to bring Freud to Hollywood. And someone like Hitchcock was clearly a devotee. My issue with this has always been, well, if these dudes like Freudianism and they're in analysis in many cases, and they're overtly, not subconsciously, bringing Freudian stories and analyses into their films, what is the point of then doing a symptomatic Freudian analysis of what they come up with?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think that's a good question, right? Like, if the film is overtly Freudian, can you then approach it in a psychoanalytic way? Because you're right, there's something about a psychoanalytic approach that is always trying to find what's unspoken in the
Yes,
text,
yes.
right? And I think, but what I would say to that is the times when, let's take Hitchcock, for example, like the times when Hitchcock is trying to be Freudian, they're the worst film, right? Like Spellbound, sorry, it's not a good film. And the dream sequence in Spellbound makes you think you should never film a dream sequence because it's terrible, right? So I feel like that you even when they're trying to do it, I don't, for one thing, I don't think it should be tried. Like, I don't think it's possible to take a theory and turn it into a narrative form. So, and because I think there's something about a theory that goes in the other direction, right? Like, I think narrative has to, or art has to come out of experience and whatever. Like, I can't think of a, like, isn't that why Camus is a greater novel, not a greater thinker, of course, but a greater novelist than Sartre? Because Sartre, it's like there's something kind of, like, I mean, I like those with Age of Reason, it's a, but there's just something sort of mechanical about Sartre's
No,
fiction.
absolutely. Raymond Williams is a better literary historian than a novelist. And Camus is a he's a better stylist than Sartre. And he's not trying to force a complex dialectic onto you, even though they're both trying to be existential. I guess the other thing is that as journalists, and of course they were both very distinguished journalists, Camus may be a better person for noticing, making little aperçu, just seeing what's out there and noting it. Whereas with Sartre, it does have to fit into a gigantic
Yeah,
model.
I think that's right. And I think that that has a negative effect on art, right? Like, I think that that, and I, so I don't think, I was trying to, I've always been fascinated by this question. Can you be a theorist who then writes a novel? And I'm not sure that you can be. Like, I'm really not, or makes a film. So I don't think I don't think it's good. Like, you know, Rilke never would go into psychoanalysis because he's like, that's the last thing I need because my poetry is,
Well, I
it
guess
feeds.
Umberto Eco would be one case of a semiotic theorist who uses semiology as the basis of part of the narrative of what have been, I think, deemed very successful and certainly quite popular novels.
These are great. That's a great exception to what I'm saying. Yeah,
But in
it's a
terms of
good point.
psychoanalysis and Marxism, and or Marxism, I think there's a question to be raised of the kind of you're probing us with, and I appreciate your putting it to us. I mean, I was in Australia for the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party there, and people who had helped to found it were still alive. This was 1980, and it had been founded in the 30s, and they were still fighting the same battles over socialist realism versus the avant-garde, versus some kind of clunky nationalism that had been going on since before the war. And I listened to this. I didn't know any of the novels or novelists, but I went away and read them. They were all crap, I thought. But they were trying to engage with representing very important social forces and the impact of their social forces on everyday life. There was something going on there that was interesting and compelling, even if not very well done in my amateur view. Do you know what I mean? So
That makes a lot of sense.
there's something there. And of course, I guess another case would be in art. You mentioned art more generally, but someone like Salvador Dali, very right-wing figure, but very creative, clearly influenced by Freudianism. On the left, Luis Buñuel, clearly influenced by these things. It's a complex one, and I think in terms of Marxism and art, I guess we could talk about the Mexican muralists of the 30s and 40s as guys very influenced by socialist realism and producing, I think, some of the great art of the 20th century. So it's a complex one, but it does make
It's a,
sense,
I think you're right to point out that there are cases where that idea isn't, that it's, there are people who have the theoretical influence that are then able to make
but
the
sometimes
great
it's
work
not
of art.
necessarily as complex as something like Freud. I mean, it's clear that Joseph Campbell had a really purposive effect on Hollywood. George Lucas, you don't get George Lucas whether you want him or not, minus Campbell. Would that be right, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's right. Isn't it interesting how I was just here listening to the actor Edward Norton talk about how he thinks about making a film, and he was talking to all these, he's talking to students mainly. He's like, the first thing you need to do is read Campbell. And I just thought I would never say that to someone. Like I would just, it would be the last thing I would say. But I think you're right about Lucas, and I think you're right about the real influence on Hollywood. And just, I was talking interestingly. So some guy, it's good because the audiences will, there'll be absolutely no overlap. But some guy had a has a podcast. It's called, I think, the $1 Million Podcast. And he saw that I had this book, Capitalism and Desire, and so he invited me on to talk about it. And I said, look, you don't want me on there. And he's like, I'm not your kind of person. And he was a nice whatever guy. And he's like, no, I don't mind having ideological opponents. It'd be good and for my audience. But he said to me an interesting thing. So he's totally for right wing. He said an interesting thing. He said, well, Campbell is the basis of all narrative and storytelling. And I mean, it's just everyone knows that. And I just said, I'm not sure everyone knows that. I don't know that. So, like, I think it's really, I think the corrosive effect of him on Hollywood, I think you're that, I mean, it's absolutely undeniable, I think. And it just was interesting to me to talk to this guy because it just shows how that idea is kind of like seeped into the infrastructure. And the fact that Norton, who's a left-leaning guy, and has made, he made a great film called Motherless Brooklyn's a great kind of very good political film even, would say it, and then this right-wing guy would say it, just to me confirms how it's just in the fabric of our because of Hollywood, I think. I mean, I think you're right about Lucas and the formative effect that Star Wars had on so many people. But I mean, I would want to say, like, look, I want to He, when he was, he said, you can't find a narrative that doesn't follow this trajectory. I said, well, I could just sit here. I'll just name about 20 great, like War and Peace. I don't know, Hamill, like that don't follow that trajectory at all. So it's just funny how, yeah, a certain ideological narrative, of course, but I found it. I mean, it's a great reference by you because I think it really, it's so pervasive and yet so
It is,
pernicious.
isn't it? And not just in cinema. I mean, everyday people find a lot to cling on to in some of these essentialist stories, whether they're pop psychology or Joseph Campbell. And there's something there that speaks to a really profound desire to sort of know yourself and know how that fits in the world in a way that isn't messy.
I think that that's a key thing, right? Like fitting, like, can I fit? Can I find a place to fit? And I think that really, in a non-messy way, as you say, I think that's really what's going on in that with that love of Campbell, but also in the love of all the stories that are Campbell's tales, right? And I think you're, and even, I mean, you could even say, I think the way he's in that image or that structure has influenced even journalism and report. Like I see it, it's just so almost ubiquitous. So it's really, I. And also the way that the preference that in the popular mind of Jung over Freud, right? I think it's the same. Like the relation between Campbell and Jung is pretty, I think, clear.
Yes,
And
absolutely, absolutely. And I wish people would read Vladimir Propp and all those psychoanalysts, because they actually did a pretty rigorous analysis of all the kinds of stories they could find, particularly folk tales. And the same with Freud and Levi Strauss and all these other dudes, who are a bit more systematic than
I
Campbell.
know, I know. Prop is amazing, and Levi Strauss. All right, I said I was going to say OC because I remember I said his name at the first. Anyway, but yeah, also, I mean, it's yeah. He's. I think you're right. Like, but it's a kind of like it's again about the non-messiness, right? Like, there's a way that Campbell is much less messy than those figures.
Now, speaking of messiness, Todd, the podcat is intervening in an aggressive way. He is particularly hungry today, and so he's running to the kitchen, which means I am walking towards it myself, in order to satisfy his. It's not the death drive; it's something else.
It's something else. Yeah, totally understood. Yeah, I
It's
like that
the
he's called the podcat. I like, is that his official
oh
name or is
well, he makes himself known. His most significant recent interventions have tended to be when I've been recording with red-headed people, because he's orange, as you may have seen.
Oh, I
And
did
there's
see
some
that.
sort of, I don't know how ocular cats really are. I don't think they are particularly. But he is very rivalrous of red-headed women. And so when they come on screen, he goes into full press, full court press. He's the kind of Dennis Rodman figure, who is waiting to use his lengthy fingernails to get rebound and take it out on Dad, but for some, sometimes it's not about people with red hair. Sometimes it's about, his gustatory desires, which are perfectly reasonable. I've only had U.S. cats in the past, and they are very pliant. They are like the ideal blue-collar American worker of the US capitalist dream. It turns out European cats are much pissier, and they're fussy. So my vet tells me, oh, this is normal.
Oh, wow.
Cats are like children. They go off the food they appeared to like. You'll be going for weeks trying to find the right formula, blah, 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 blah. Which turns out to be true, and I keep saying it's because they're Spanish and people don't like hearing that here.
Huh. I
Whereas,
did not know about this difference between
well,
the
it's
American cat. Yeah.
I fabricated. Oh, I'm basing it on limited experience.
Well, but still, I mean, I think that it is, I think you are right that the American cat is relatively pliant to your, like our cat basically kind of follows us around and does. The only thing that cats don't do, as far as I've noticed, American cats, they don't let you just pick them up at will. Like that's the, at least ours don't. They
No, that's
resist that.
true. And he does allow that. He
Oh.
does allow that. It's just the food thing where he's so demanding and so hard to satisfy, And one of
Yeah.
the many mad promises made by artificial intelligence, I don't know if you've seen this one, Todd, is to
No.
make the behavior of cats understandable.
Wow. How are they going to do that?
Well, I think it's so many images of what they do and what precedes what they do and what follows what they do and their patterns of conduct. So it's ultimately behavioralist. But I think a few behavioralist animal psychologists have tried that on in the last century. Good luck, dude.
Good luck.
Anyway, sorry to move on to that.
No, that's okay.
Back to psychoanalysis and cinema. One of the other people who's been important in that field and important for your own work is Lacan. And I wonder if you could give us an idea of where his work comes in to add to or subtract from, supplement that of Freud when it comes to psychoanalytic film studies.
Yeah, film studies. So Lacan was like the figure in the 1970s when psychoanalytic film theory exploded. The problem is that it really took, and this is actually a problem of the dissemination of Lacan's thought, because basically his Écrits, his writings, were published in 66, but none of the seminars, which I think, and I don't think this is a controversial position, but that's where the real meat of his theory is. None of the seminars had been released in the early 70s when psychoanalytic film theory developed. And the result is that this essay on the mirror stage becomes the paradigm for understanding cinema. And I think that's really, really lamentable because even as early as the second seminar, so in the mid 50s, Lacan said the mirror stage is already a bit dated. I'm not so invested in it. And yet these theorists are like hyper invested in it. So, and they want to say the mirror, the screen is a mirror. Joan Kopcak, who's one of the first to really oppose this way of thinking, said, no, the screen's not a mirror, the mirror is a screen. And that's a really, it's an interesting contrast because it opens up the space for what Lacan calls the gaze, which for these early theorists was the look of the camera on the image, right? And but Lacan's idea of the gaze, it develops in Seminar 11, the four fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis, is the opposite. The gaze is an object that disrupts the visual field. So and so what's great about cinema for people fall later theorists is that it can have this moment at this object where you see the way in which your desire is written into the image, right? And so it does this at this point where it doesn't, things don't exactly fit in the image. And Hitchcock's one of the greatest on this. I always like to talk about the moment at the end of Psycho, or not the end, in the middle of Psycho, where Norman cleans up after the death of Marion gently, and he's clean, and then he sinks her car into the swamp in the back, and it stops before it goes down. And Hitchcock holds it for maybe 15 seconds, and you don't, and the point is that you're like, wait a minute, get down. You want that car to go down. And then, but if you think about it, you're like, wait a minute, I'm rooting for this guy to cover up a murder. Why am I rooting? Why is my desire invested? So that's a moment of gaze where you see this thing that doesn't quite fit within the structure. So that I see that as the trajectory of psychoanalytic film theory as influenced by Lacan. First, it has this very mirror he stage heavy thing, and then this focus on the gaze, even though people talked about the gaze earlier, they weren't really talking about the gaze. They were just talking about mirror stage.
And this relates somewhat to one of the topics that you deal with in some of your work that I've read, which is questions of identification. And more broadly, not just in film, identity. So I wondered if we could do a couple of things, not necessarily together, it could be consecutively. One, to talk about identification with character, and the other, to talk about the question of universality and identity, which is in another book, a fairly recent one. So could we start with the question of these two I words? Could we start with the question of identification, please?
So I think that identification, the identification with it. So just to be clear, that early psychoanalytic film theory was very invested in identification. They thought that was the primary process at work in cinematic spectatorship. I don't think that, but I think how identification works in the cinema, I think is kind of how it works in actual life too. That you through the image of someone or through their whatever position that they have in the social order, you identify yourself with them, and through that, and this is an idea a little bit from Lacan. I think there's some Freud in it. Through that identification, through that seeing of yourself in that other, you get a sense of who you are. So I'll give you a very embarrassing example from my days in high school. So I there was a player on the team that I played on who was a year older, and he was at my high school, and he would constantly make this, I don't know why he did it, but he would constantly rock back and forth. He'd never stand still. And then, but he was a very, everyone liked him. He was very attractive, whatever. And good, great player. And I started to take that up over the summer after no one could see me. And then I started doing it in school. I did it until someone said, wait, aren't you, isn't that how that other guy acted? And then so then I immediately stopped and never did it again. But to me, that's what's interesting is I think that's how all of our identity gets taken up. And I think that's the psychoanalytic idea that we see it something that we imagine that the other is or is doing, and then we start to do it ourselves and imagine ourselves that. Like we think, oh, I'm going to, or we take up a certain kind of symbolic position. We talk, you just address me as professor or prof. Like that's a symbolic identity, right? And I think a lot of people want to try to identify with a certain position, like even parent, right? Like that's a symbolic identity that I want to try to think of myself as a good parent. And so you're, the identification, I think that works just like it works in the cinema. Like you see someone on the screen and you're trying to imagine yourself in that position. And from that, I think a lot of people, I mean, this is the source of that, I think pretty good Woody, I don't think he directed it, but Play It Again, Sam, where he sees the image of Humphrey Bogart on the screen and then he tries to model his life on that. And I think that's like the ne plus ultra of identification, but that, I think that's how it works. You see a figure and then you try to take that as a model for yourself. But I think it always, this is what I, to lead to your other question, I think it always fails. Like you never, there's always a disjunction within identity, right? No matter how well I identify with a certain position or with a certain figure, I'm never quite there. And I think that failure is universality. Like that's why we have this universal connection, that universality is the failure of every identity. So that's, I see that those, that's how I think of those terms, those ideas together.
One of the arguments that I think you're making in the universality and identity dilemma or intersection is that the great revolutionary ideals that come from the Enlightenment are incarnate more in the founding documentation of the French Revolution than in the American one. I think I've got that right. Yeah.
Absolutely true. I
Pretty
absolutely
important
believe
chunk.
that. Yeah.
Could you elaborate a bit on that for us?
Yeah, because I think that the problem to my mind with the American is that there's a real elision. This speaks to the guy on your shirt, like a real elision of the economic, right? Like there's no, and also there's no life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is the American, right? And liberté, égalité, fraternité is the French. And I think that what's missing is the idea of solidarity. And also what's missing is the, like this idea of pursuing happiness. I find one of the most pernicious ideas. And I think that that's one of the things that the French Revolution totally avoids. But I think the other thing that it gets at more appropriately is, so both the economic, like Robespierre was convinced that if we didn't have an economic shift, there wouldn't, the political shift would die out. And I think that that ended up, he was proven absolutely correct about that. And there's no figure like that on the American side. The
American
other thing that
state,
happened, yeah, the other thing that happened in France, of course, is that the Jacobins supported the end of the colonies, and there's there the whole point of the American Constitution is that it preserved slavery. So I think that that's a, that to me is one of the fundamental differences. That so Hannah, I think this is not a, I think this is not a, my, this is the, what I'm saying. I think most people think that the French Revolution is the more radical one. It's interesting that Hannah Arendt is the exception. She's like thought the American is really, in her little book On Revolution, the American is really the model. And it's because, but I think it's because she didn't care about, she just didn't care about slavery. She just didn't care about it. So she didn't think that was a really important question. And she also certainly didn't care about economic disparity or inequality.
I think
So,
there's such a, sorry, go ahead.
no, that's all I was going to say.
I think there is such a lot of baggage, and I'm not saying this necessarily applied to Arendt's interpretation, around the US Constitution that will not admit that the fundamental originary aspect of founding the colonies was a fight with it between English slave owners, some living in the United States, some not, over the conditions of slavery and how they could both benefit best from it. And this
Right,
just cannot be said. Obama clearly knows that. Clinton clearly knows that. for example. Any decent historian knows that. But no journalist will say it. They will say slavery is terrible, but they won't say it's the thing. In the same way that when the British talk about the Industrial Revolution, they crap on about the labor process, relevant. They crap on about new technology, relevant. They won't talk about the labor process as in slavery in the Caribbean and all the products that came to Britain that were then sold around the world, courtesy of black slave labor. You know, and I mean, it is astonishing the way that these things can barely be said. So I think it's a very important insight in your book.
Well, thank you. I also think if I can just say it right, I also think that that isn't the key, that the French Revolution in a certain way facilitates, or the Haitian Revolution is in its wake, right? In a way that it's not in the wake of the American Revolution at all, right? And I think that it's to your point, right? That's another, what is a massively unspoken thing today. I think it doesn't get the kind of press that it deserves. And I also think Haiti is another, it's like even today, it's this like neglect, like no, just like no matter how, what the horror is, no one cares, right? Like it's even, in that sense, it's even a more horrific situation than Palestine, because just no one even, it doesn't even make the news, right? Like it's just, and like right now, people in Haiti are basically entrapped in all the border. There's a blockade around the country, so no one can even flee. So it's like it's a horror, and it's exactly, I mean, to me, it's exactly what you're speaking about. That just can't be, these things that can't be spoken, right?
And ironically, of course, the two powers that decide what creates this mess over and over again in Haiti are France and, to a lesser extent, USA. I mean, sorry,
Yeah,
to a greater
exactly.
extent,
Nope.
USA. You know,
Exactly,
that's
exactly. Like,
the terrible irony.
I know, and they had to, like, in order for Napoleon not to reconquer Haiti, they had to pay slave reparations. Like, you think like reparations are paid by the former masters? No, they're paid. So they were basically from 1804 to 1940 indebted to France. And then you're right, and then the USA systematically intervened anytime. Aristide's the latest example, but it's interesting, like now, like an intervention would be welcome, and of course they're not doing anything, but which is just as horrific.
I find it very troubling that so many horrendous world events, many of them so close to the United States and so influenced by the United States, do not get the attention that they should. But I wanted to jump onto another thing, Prof, because I've actually got two more questions, if I may,
Okay.
and then I
Yeah,
want
sure.
to hand things to you to add anything. And you might be adding to something we've already discussed, or it might be something new.
Okay.
So my first question is to ask you about universality versus identity, because my problem with the critique of universality is that I haven't met any brand of thought that isn't universalizing. I just don't know it. Religious, tribal, linguistic, it seems to me they come up with supposedly universal accounts of the subject, even though the postmodern critique of this is to say, no, there must be less lumping and more splitting, as it were. So I
Right.
wonder if you could reflect on that question a bit, or that conceit on my part.
Yeah, I mean, I totally share it. I think it's a, I don't know how more people don't think that, frankly. You know, I find it puzzling that it's not just self-evident to people. It's kind of like, it makes me think of how Edmund Husserl thought when he was critiquing skepticism. He's like, isn't it just obvious that this can't, you can't sustain this position because it's self-contradictory. Like, you have to be skeptical of your skepticism, and then you wouldn't be a skeptic anymore. So you can't have a total, like the skeptical account, it undermines itself. Same thing with this anti-universality. Like, you, the refu you, because you're claiming, you're making a universal claim that there can't be universals. So that's universality. So I don't understand how you get out of it. Just it just seems like it would take like 20 seconds of thinking about it, and you would be like, okay, right, I can't be a particularist because that's an impossible position to occupy. But all I can say is I think sometimes the more impossible it is to think a position, the more psychically appealing that position is, right? Like the very, and I think this is, we see this in these right-wing political movements today. I think the more a position asks you to deny your thinking, right? The more you're going to invest yourself in it. And I think that level of fetishistic disavowal, I think we're wrong to think that it's reserved for the right. And I think what you're just pointing out is the way that this is operative in this rampant particularism today. I'm as against what's happening in Gaza as much as the next person, next leftist. But I so often I hear students of mine articulate in a particularist way why they're against it, right? And I'm just like, no, there has to be, it's in the name of universal values that you're against it, right? But it's not because of this annihilation of the particular people that are there and not letting them have their own land and all the, like, that can't be the value that you're articulating, because for one thing, those are right-wing values. And the second thing is that that's not, that can't, you can't think, you have to have a, that belongs in a universalist framework if you're even articulating it. So I can't tell you how, I part of me is tempted to say the problem all stems from the fact that Hegel wasn't quite clear enough when he wrote that sense certainty chapter in the Phenomenology. If he was just a better writer, we'd all be saved, because he's very clear, right? Like, if you, everything you want to, or the most specific thing you want to articulate, you're doing it with a universal. Sorry. Like, that's sorry. That's so, yeah, just I'm totally with you on that. I couldn't be more with you. And I'm mystified every time I come up against this, but I come up against it. I can't tell you how often. Like, I would say, so I teach in a English department. I would say I have a few colleagues that are my on sort of theoretically proximate to me, but I would say like 95% of my colleagues are just complete particularists. They think like any invocation of the universal is, and they, some of them are Marxists, which is the craziest thing. It's crazy. Like, but they are Marxists who are absolute particularists. So I don't know what to, that, and it's, I don't know what to do, but I just, to me, that just shows how intellectually dominant that line of thinking is. Sorry for going
No, not at
on
all.
in.
That's what this is meant to evoke. And I think that part of this, in the case of some friends of mine who are prone to that protest, is a dislike of the dialectic, a dislike of the idea of a split subject that you get in Hegel, who is the subject split between, or you get in Kant, language and reality, that then becomes doubly split perforce the division of labor in Marx. And they
Right,
don't think that that describes subjectivity. Now, I don't think you have to accept or reject that account to admit that people who keep particularizing things are actually operating in a universalist frame. But I think that's
No.
part of the explanation for what you perceive. So, my last question, Prof, and then as I said, I just want to throw it to you to talk about anything you wish, really,
Okay.
is something that Althusser clearly gets from Lacan, maybe on the couch as a patient, I don't know, and is very important for people like Terry Eagleton when he's in his Althusserian phase, and is clearly important for lots of psychoanalytic Marxist thinking, which is the imaginary and the symbolic. I wonder if you could take us through those concepts and say whether they seem of value to you.
Yeah, I think they're a value. I think that I think there's an argument that Lacan's tripartite division of our experience is maybe his greatest contribution. So I do think, like, a lot of his jargon, I never, like, someone asked me, Can you write an essay on la langue for our journal? This idea of la, in French, it's so la langue means the languages for the people listening, means language, the language, but Lacan merges it together. And I said, you know, I can't do that because I've never once written this term except in this email to you. So I'm not going to do it. So that's how I feel about most of his jargon. I'm so against jargon. And I think jargon is a, and neologisms, I despise them. It's hard to read Heidegger if you have an anti-neologistic framework, but I've managed to do it. But I think these are three that are, I mean, they're not neologisms. Obviously, these words exist, but I think they're valuable. I do think it's a valuable way of thinking. And the way I think of it, this is one thing that this is helpful for me. So I think the symbolic is the place from which I see, right? The imaginary is the, or from which I perceive. The imaginary is the field that I perceive. And then the real is what disrupts that field, what can't fit in that field, what's impossible in that field. And so that to me is the way that I think of it. So the symbolic is the framing. And I think Lacan was concerned with the way we're deceived by the imaginary, because we're deceived that what we don't think about how where we look from shapes what we think. And I think it's a first, in a certain way, it's a, just a good materialist point by Lacan in conjuring up the symbolic. And I think that when he adds the real into that, he gets this idea that, okay, there's something that doesn't fit, right? And we talked before about people wanting to find ways to fit, and Joseph Campbell. And I think the real is his way of saying, look, there's ultimately there's just there's going to be a failure to fit, and that's the end of the game. So I feel like those are still important to me. I mean, I again, I try not to capitalize real and do all these things, but I do think it's, or capitalize symbolic. But yeah, I think there's something beneficial, and I think just for that, right, just to get that distinction between that the point of departure, or the point of frame, and then how you experience it.
Thanks for that. So now to conclude, I was about to say prof, but I know I'm not allowed to.
No, you see, it's okay. I've adjusted. It's okay.
No, one should be addressed in the way one wishes.
I don't know about that.
I think that's a perfectly reasonable request. So, Todd, I'm wondering if to conclude, there are things you'd like to add. And as I said, they may be things that touch on areas we've already discussed, or it might be new material.
Okay, so let's try a joke out, okay? I don't think I've ever told this joke before, but your shirt inspired me to tell it. So here's a shirt with Marx on the cover that says "Class dismissed." So this joke, obviously, the frame of the joke is made up, because Marx was 14, I think, when Hegel, or 13 when Hegel died. So, but the, you have to go with it. So Marx has taken a class in philosophy, history of philosophy, from Hegel at the University of Berlin. And he takes his class, starts at 9 a.m. And every class, it meets every day. And every day at 9:25, class goes till 10. 9:25, Marx leaves. Happens like first day, second day, third day. And finally, on the fourth day, Hegel, on the beginning of the fifth day, the next day of class, Hegel stops Marx before class starts and says, "Look, I see you. I see you, leaving class early." He's like, "I just, and you leave at the same time every day. It's just, it's troubling to me. I like, am I not engaging? What's happening?" And Marx goes, no, it's not that at all." He goes, "I have a problem. Is I have a class on Immanuel Kant with Professor Schelling at 9:30, so I have to leave and get to it." And Hegel's like, "Well, what is going on? Why is this? Why do you have classes in this way?" He goes, and Marx goes, "Well, you know, it's this bourgeois university. They don't believe in class conflict." So that's my your class dismissed. I mean, you could do a lot with that too, I think, with class dismissed. So
That's funny.
yeah. So
That's
I've never told that before, but I don't know that I made it up, although I might have. I have a file. This is my favorite. This is my, I'm telling, I'll reveal my like darkest sins on your podcast. So I have a file, and it's there. It's quite long of theory jokes, like jokes about theorists, and a lot about Lacan, a lot about Hegel, A few about Marx is good because Marx, you have the name, it kind of goes
You
in a
know
lot of
what?
different
If Netflix
directions.
had been around in the 90s, you probably would have gotten a special.
I don't know about that though. I don't like the problem is the jokes have such a limited audience. I taught a whole class on Lacan and the French thriller, and I thought I'm going to be able to use all these Lacan jokes, but they didn't know enough about the theory, so I kept having to say, okay, you got to understand this in the background, and then so, but that
Yeah, no, I
it didn't
mean,
work.
that is not what Chris Rock does in order.
No, he doesn't have to do that. And then the Hegel's even worse. I mean, you can't.
Well, you know, the two stories that I uncovered, you're probably aware of this, I wasn't until I was researching it, of how Hegel funded himself when he wasn't lecturing, what he did before. So one version is that he was a highfalutin editor of a newspaper, right?
Right.
The other is that he was a stringer who wrote sports coverage of wild boar hunts and sold his stories to different papers.
Oh my God, I did not know that. I thought I've read every biographical thing about Hegel. Is that during the time when he was working at the newspaper or
Well,
before?
this is meant to be his work. Well, there's one version that says he was never really a full-timer. He
Oh, okay.
never had editorial control, that this is a myth, and that in fact he was running around making notes of people running at racing after wild boar. I mean,
Wow.
and I have no way of knowing which of these is true or whether they are both true, but about different points in history.
Right.
But look it up. Look up Wild
Okay,
Boar
okay.
Hunt, Hegel journalism. You will find, I'm not, I mean, I do make things up a lot, but I am very sure that I'm
Okay.
not making this up.
This is one of the theories. Wow. Okay, because I of course know the working at the newspaper, but I did not know. Yeah. Wow.
So look
That's
up Hegel
great.
Wild Boar because
Okay.
it's,
Okay.
you know,
Yeah.
it's,
Yeah, that is great. Yeah, I love
and
the
so
idea of
The dialectic is between being an editor and being a stringer, racing after guys, racing after wild boar they're trying to kill.
Yeah, that's I love how the idea of Hegel as a sports reporter.
I
I mean,
know. Well,
he
this will appeal to you as a Bengals fan. Yeah. So listen, Todd, thank you very, very much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I admire your work, and it was great to have the chance to learn not only
Toby.
from reading it, but from chatting to you.
Toby, absolutely wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much.